Hello, I'm Kristen Marchand, and this is the Opiongo Line, a podcast dedicated to preserving the local heritage and unique culture of the Upper Madawaska and Opiongo River Valleys here in Eastern Ontario, Canada. Well, it's that time of year again. St. Valentine's Day is just around the corner, and so our thoughts, and we suspect many of your thoughts, will now turn over the next few days towards a mad rush for chocolates, flowers, shiny baubles, and such. And those silly Valentine's cards that say, I love you, and that can hopefully still be bought, maybe even up to and including the very last minute. Now, we've never been one of those who look askance at anyone's humble effort to live up to that high watermark set by mythical St. Valentine, dying, we are told, for love. But just to set the record straight, we're not about to offer up any chocolates, flowers, or cheesy trinkets, nor any of those ham-fisted, smoopy lyrics festooning a flimsy piece of overpriced pink cardboard folded over on itself. Rather, our ever-attentive research department has been hard at work rifling through thousands of dusty old books to see what men and women of character have been saying about love, but more importantly, how they express that love to someone who really matters to them. Better still, our researchers have uncovered what some very famous men and women have been writing privately to each other over the years about their burning passion. And, as luck would have it, we've sorted through all of those dusty piles and eventually come up with 20 love letters that date as far back as the 12th century and as recently as the middle of the last century. What a treasure trove it turned out to be. Indeed, we had to recruit nearly every member of the Opiongo Readers Theatre just to whisper those sweet nothings to you today. Joining us are Jeff Bowman, Leslie Betts, Karen and Rob Filipkowski, Carol and Brian Peterson, John Stephen, Lynn Stewart, and Mark Wormke, all here to give you, perhaps, just the right bon mot, those precious few words or phrases that you may want to steal, or use, on those empty Hallmark cards that, we know, are all staring blankly back at you this very moment, and all expecting just the right few words to let your main squeeze know you're in this mess with them for keeps. The letters that the Opiongo Readers Theatre are about to read, as one might expect, range from the sublime to the ridiculous. Some are heartwarming, others heartbreaking, some dramatic, others sad and lonely, while still others are happy beyond belief, if not ecstatic, and one, well, we couldn't help ourselves. It's just plain weird. You be the judge of which one. Everyone has different tastes and different reactions to being in love, and not even our very own Opiongo Readers Theatre members could agree on which letter was the most sublime, or which was the most ridiculous. The first pair of letters, however, everyone agrees represents probably the most tragic love affair in the history of mankind, that of Heloise and Abelard. If you don't know about them, time maybe for a little Google research, if not a trot down to the nearest public library before St. Valentine's Day. Suffice it to say, Abelard was the most renowned intellectual in the 12th century, and Heloise was his very bright and beautiful 17-year-old student. What happened next, thanks to Heloise's violent uncle, once he found out that the pair had fallen madly in love, is one of the most heinous crimes against St. Valentine, if not humanity, best not even to be mentioned today. What it meant for the pair of lovebirds at the time, however, was that Heloise was spent the rest of her life in a nunnery, and Abelard was banished to a monastery, and never would the two ever meet again in this life. But, years into their unjust punishment, Abelard happened to write to a friend about his still simmering love for Heloise, and as luck would have it, Heloise was given a copy of that very letter. She read it with misgivings, but soon there began an exchange of extraordinary and wonderful love letters like the world has never seen before and has never seen since. Here is Lynn Stewart reading that first letter from Heloise after letting her curiosity get the better of her and reading that first letter that Abelard had sent to his friend. Jeff Bowman then reads Abelard's response.
But how dear did my curiosity cost me? What disturbance did it occasion, and how surprised I was to find the whole letter filled with a particular and melancholy account of our misfortunes. The length of time ought to have closed up my wounds, yet seeing them described by you was sufficient to make them all open and bleed afresh. Surely all the misfortunes of lovers are conveyed to them through the eyes. Upon reading your letter, I feel all mine renewed. Observe, I beseech you, to what a wretched condition you have reduced me, sad, afflicted, without any possible comfort unless it proceed from you. Be not then unkind, nor deny me, I beg of you, that little relief which you only can give. Let me have a faithful account of all that concerns you. I would know everything, be it ever so unfortunate. Perhaps by mingling my sighs with yours, I may make your sufferings less, for it has been said that all sorrows divided are made lighter. I shall always have this, if you please, and it will always be agreeable to me, that when I receive a letter from you, I shall know you still remember me. I have your picture in my room. I never pass it without stopping to look at it. If a picture, which is but a mute representation of an object, can give such pleasure, what cannot letters inspire? We may write to each other, so innocent a pleasure is not denied us. I shall read that you are my husband, and you shall see me sign myself your wife. In spite of all our misfortunes, you may be what you please in your letter. Having lost the substantial pleasures of seeing and possessing you, I shall in some measure compensate this loss by the satisfaction I shall find in your writing. There I shall read your most sacred thoughts. I shall carry them always about with me. I shall kiss them every moment. I cannot live if you will not tell me that you still love me. When you write to me, you will write to your wife. Marriage has made such a correspondence lawful, and since you can without the least scandal satisfy me, why will you not? I am not only engaged by my vows, but I have the fear of my uncle before me. There is nothing, then, that you need dread. You have been the occasion of all my misfortunes. You therefore must be the instrument of my comfort. You cannot but remember, for lovers cannot forget, with what pleasure I have passed whole days in hearing your discourse, how, when you were absent, I shut myself from everyone to write to you, how uneasy I was till my letter had come to your hands, and what artful management it required to engage messengers. This detail perhaps surprises you, and you are in pain for what may follow. But I am no longer ashamed that my passion for you had no bounds, for I have done more than all this. I have hated myself that I might love you. I came hither to ruin myself in a perpetual imprisonment that I might make you live quietly and at ease. Nothing but virtue, joined to a love perfectly disengaged from the senses, could have produced such effects. Vice never inspires anything like this. It is too enslaved to the body. This was my cruel uncle's notion. He measured my virtue by the frailty of my sex, and thought it was the man and not the person I loved. But he has been guilty to no purpose. I love you more than ever, and so revenge myself on him. I will still love you with all the tenderness of my soul, till the last moment of my life. You cannot but be entirely persuaded of this by the extreme unwillingness I showed to marry you, though I knew that the name of wife was honorable in the world and holy in religion. Yet the name of your mistress had greater charms because it was more free. The bonds of matrimony, however honorable, still bear with them a necessary engagement, and I was very unwilling to be necessitated to love always a man who would perhaps not always love me. I despised the name of wife, that I might live happy with that of mistress. My misfortune was to have cruel relatives whose malice destroyed the calm we enjoyed. Had they been reasonable, I had now been happy in the enjoyment of my dear husband. Oh, how cruel were they when their blind fury urged a villain to surprise you in your sleep! Where was I? Where was your Eloise then? What joy should I have had in defending my lover? I would have guarded you from violence at the expense of my life. Oh, whither does this excess of passion hurry me? Here, love is shocked, and modesty deprives me of words. Among those who are wedded to God, I am wedded to a man. Among the heroic supporters of the cross, I am the slave of a human desire. At the head of a religious community, I am devoted to Abelard alone. Even here, I love you as much as ever I did in the world. If I had loved pleasures, could I not have found means to gratify myself? I was not more than 22 years old, and there were other men left, though I was deprived of Abelard. And yet, I buried myself in a nunnery and triumphed over life at an age capable of enjoying it to its full latitude. It is to you I sacrifice these remains of a transitory beauty, these widowed nights and tedious days. Oh, think of me. Do not forget me. Remember my love and fidelity and constancy. Love me as your mistress. Cherish me as your child, your sister, your wife. Remember I still love you, and yet strive to avoid loving you. What a terrible saying is this. I shake with horror, and my very heart revolts against what I say. I shall blot all my paper with tears. I end my long letter wishing you, if you desire it, would to heaven I could, forever adieu.
If my passion has been put under a restraint, my thoughts yet run free. I promise myself that I will forget you, and yet cannot think of it without loving you. After a multitude of useless endeavors, I begin to persuade myself that it is a superfluous trouble to strive to free myself, and that it is sufficient wisdom to conceal from all but you how confused and weak I am. I remove to a distance from your person with an intention of avoiding you as an enemy. And yet I incessantly seek for you in my mind. I recall your image in my memory, and in different disquietudes I betray and contradict myself. I hate you. I love you. You call me your master. It is true you were entrusted to my care. I saw you. I was earnest to teach you. It cost you your innocence and me my liberty. If now, having lost the power of satisfying my passion, I had also lost that of loving you, I should have some consolation. But I find myself much more guilty in my thoughts of you, even amidst my tears, than in possessing you when I was in full liberty. I continually think of you. I continually call to mind your tenderness. Oh, do not add to my miseries by your constancy. Forget, if you can, your favors and that right which they claim over me. Allow me to be indifferent. Why use your eloquence to reproach me for my flight and for my silence? Spare the recital of our assignations and your constant exactness to them. Without calling up such disturbing thoughts, I have enough to suffer. What great advantages would philosophy give us over other men if by studying it we could learn to govern our passions? What a troublesome employment is love! Those charms, that beauty, that air which I yet behold at this instant occasioned my fall. Your looks were the beginning of my guilt. Your eyes, your discourse pierced my heart. And in spite of that ambition and glory which tried to make a defense, love was soon the master. Even now, my love burns fiercer amidst the happy indifference of those who surround me. The gospel is a language I do not understand when it opposes my passion. Void of all relish for virtue, without concern for my condition, and without application to my studies, I am continually present by my imagination where I ought not to be, and I find I have no power to correct myself. Make yourself amends by so glorious a choice, Make your virtue a spectacle worthy of men and angels. Drink of the chalice of saints, even to the bottom, without turning your eyes with uncertainty upon me. To forget Heloise, to see her no more, is what heaven demands of Abelard. And to expect nothing from Abelard, to forget him even as an idea, is what heaven enjoins on Heloise. God rejected my offering and my prayer and continued my punishment by suffering me to continue my love. Thus I bear alike the guilt of your vows and of the passion that preceded them, and must be tormented all the days of my life. To love Heloise truly is to leave her to that quiet which retirement and virtue afford. I've resolved it. This letter shall be my last. Adieu. I hope you will be willing, when you have finished this mortal life, to be buried near me. Your cold ashes need then fear nothing, and my tomb shall be more rich and renowned.
Our next letter is no less tragic. Many people know about Sir Walter Raleigh, if only as the man who brought tobacco back to England from the New World late in the 16th century. What many people don't know is that he ended his days in 1618 with his head on a chopping block, executed by the British Crown. In the wee hours of the morning during that awful night before his execution, Sir Walter Raleigh wrote this last letter to his wife, Bess. Here is John Stephen reading it.
You shall now receive, my dear wife, my last words in these last lines. My love, I send you them that you may keep it when I am dead, and my counsel that you may remember it when I am no more. I would not by my will present you with sorrows, dear Bess. Let them go to the grave with me and be buried in the dust. And seeing that it is not God's will that I should see you any more in this life, bear it patiently, and with a heart like thyself. First, I send you all the thanks which my heart can conceive, or my words can rehearse, for your many travails and care taken from me, which though they have not taken effect as you wished, yet my debt to you is not the less, but pay it I never shall in this world. Secondly, I beseech you, for the love you bear me living, do not hide yourself many days, but by your travail seek to help your miserable fortunes and the right of your poor child. Thy mourning cannot avail me. I am but dust. Thirdly, you shall understand that my land was conveyed bona fide to my child. The writings were drawn at midsummer. My honest cousin Brett can testify as such, and Dolberry too, can remember somewhat. And I trust my blood will quench their malice that has cruelly murdered me, and that they will not seek also to kill thee and thine with extreme poverty. To what friend to direct thee I know not, for all mine have left me in the true time of trial. And I perceive that my death was determined from the first day. Most sorry I am, God knows, that being thus surprised with death, I can leave you in no better estate. God is my witness, I meant you all my office of wines, or all that I could have purchased by selling it, and all my jewels, but someone for the boy. But God hath prevented all my resolutions. Thank great God that ruleth all, but if you live free from want, care for no more, for the rest is but vanity. Love God, and begin betimes to repose yourself upon him. Have travailed and wearied your thoughts over all sorts of worldly cogitations, you shall but sit down by sorrow in the end. Teach your son also to love and fear God while he is yet young, that the fear of God may grow in him, and then God will be a husband to you, and a father to him, a husband and a father which cannot be taken from you. Bailey oweth me £200, and Adrian Gilbert £600. In Jersey I also have much owing me besides. The arrearages of the wines will pay my debts, and howsoever you do, pay all poor men. When I am gone, no doubt you shall be sought for by many, for the world thinks that I was very rich. But take heed of the pretenses of men and their affections, for they last not but in honest and worthy men. And no greater misery can befall you in this life than to become a prey, and afterwards to be despised. I spoke not this, God knows, to dissuade you from marriage, for it will be best for you, both in respect of the world and of God. As for me, I am no more yours, nor you mine. Death hath cut us asunder, and God hath divided me from the world, and you from me. Remember your poor child for his father's sake, who chose you and loved you in his happiest times. Get those letters, if it be possible, which I wrote to the lords, wherein I sued for my life. God is my witness, it was for you and yours that I desired life. But it is true that I disdained myself for begging of it. For know it, my dear wife, that your son is the son of a true man, and one who in his own respect despiseth death and all his misshapen and ugly forms. I cannot write much, God knows how I steal time while others sleep. And it is also time that I should separate my thoughts from the world. Beg my dead body, which living was denied thee, and either lay it at Sherburne, if the land continue, or in Exeter Church by my father and mother. I can say no more. Time and death call me away. The everlasting God, powerful, infinite, and omnipotent, that almighty God who is goodness itself, the true life and true light, keep thee in thine. Have mercy on me, and teach me to forgive my persecutors and false accusers, and send us to meet in his glorious kingdom. My dear wife, farewell. Bless my poor boy, pray for me, and let my good God hold you both in his arms. Written with the dying hand of sometime thy husband, but now, alas, overthrown. Yours that was, but now not my own. Walter Raleigh.
Of course, not all love ends in tragedy. Take that wily Scot, Robbie Burns, who certainly knew how to wheedle his way into more than one woman's heart. Here's a letter read by Rob Filipkowski that Burns wrote to a fair young damsel late in the 18th century.
Dear madam, the passion of love has need to be productive of much delight, as where it takes through possession of the man, it almost unfits him for anything else. The lover who is certain of an equal return of affection is surely the happiest of men. But he who is a prey to the horrors of anxiety and dreaded disappointment is a being whose situation is by no means enviable. Of this, my present experience gives me much proof. To me, amusement seems impertinent, and business intrusion, while you alone engross every faculty of my mind. May I request you to drop me a line to inform me when I may wait upon you? For pity's sake, do, and let me have it soon. In the meantime, allow me, in all the artless sincerity of truth, to assure you that I truly am, my dearest madam, your ardent lover and devoted humble servant.
But of course, if you really want to hear the sound of burning passion, who doesn't, we couldn't recommend highly enough one of the great love letter writers of all time, Napoleon Bonaparte. Listen up as Napoleon scribbles away, waxing eloquently as he thinks of the object of his desire, his beloved Josephine. It's read by Brian Peterson.
December 1795. I wake filled of thoughts of you, your portrait, and the intoxicating evening we spent yesterday have left my senses in turmoil. Sweet, incomparable Josephine, what a strange effect you have on my heart. Are you angry? Do I see you looking sad? Are you worried? My soul aches with sorrow, and there can be no rest for your lover. But is there still more in store for me when, yielding to the profound feelings which overwhelm me, I draw from your lips, from your heart, a love which consumes me with fire. Ah, it was last night that I finally realized how false an image of you your portrait gives. You are leaving at noon. I shall see you in 3 hours. Until then, mille doce amour. 1,000 kisses. But give me none in return, for they set my blood on fire.
Contrary to popular belief, not all passionate men who talk of love are French. To wit, there's never been anybody quite like Lord Byron, that famous British poet who is also the world's first international and hugely notorious celebrity. He made no bones about pursuing any object of his desire, regardless of whether they were married or not. Here's Mark Wormke reading Lord Byron's first letter to the very happily married 26-year-old Lady Caroline Lamb. Byron had just met her, found her irresistible, and had caused her no end of embarrassment by his unwanted attentions.
August 1812. My dearest Caroline, if tears which you saw and know I'm not apt to shed, if the agitation in which I parted from you, agitation which you must have perceived through the whole of this most nervous affair, did not commence till the moment of leaving you approached, if all that I have said and done and am still but too ready to say and do have not sufficiently proved what my real feelings are and must be ever towards you, my love, I have no other proof to offer. God knows I wish you happy, and when I quit you, or rather when you, from a sense of duty to your husband and mother, quit me, you shall acknowledge the truth of what I again promise and vow, that no other in word or deed shall ever hold the place in my affection which is and shall be most sacred to you till I am nothing. I never knew till that moment the madness. My dearest and most beloved friend, I cannot express myself. This is no time for words. But I shall have a pride, a melancholy pleasure in suffering what you yourself can hardly conceive, for you do not know me. I am now about to go out with a heavy heart, because my appearing this evening will stop any absurd story which the events of today might give rise to. Do you think now that I am cold and stern and artful? Will others think so? Will your mother even? That mother to whom we must indeed sacrifice much more on my part than she shall ever know or can imagine. Promises not to love you? Ah, Caroline, it is past promising, but I shall attribute all concessions to the proper motive and never cease to feel all that you have already witnessed, and more than can ever be known but to my own heart, perhaps to yours. May God protect, forgive, and bless you ever and even more than ever. Yours most attached, Byron. Postscript. These taunts which have driven you to this, my dearest Caroline, were it not for your mother and the kindness of all your connections, is there anything on earth or heaven would have made me so happy as to have made you mine long ago? And not less now than then, but more than ever at this time, you know, I would with pleasure give up all here and all beyond the grave for you. And in refraining from this, must my motives be misunderstood? I care not who knows this, what use is made of it. It is you and to you only. I was and am yours, freely and most entirely, to obey, to honor, love, and fly with you when, where, and how you yourself might and may determine.
Lord Byron was not an easy young man to say no to. Though Lady Caroline was 2 years older and presumably wiser than the 24-year-old Lord Byron, Caro, as he liked to call her, ultimately succumbed to his poetic charms. After the affair, and after she was tossed aside, she made famous the quip still applied to Lord Byron today as a man mad, bad, and dangerous to know. About 10 years after the affair, and while still relatively young, Lord Byron died while fighting in a European war, and so his biographers began retelling his often wild and tumultuous story. As such, Lady Caroline Lamb was ultimately forced to write a letter of her own to one of Byron's biographers, if only to set the record straight. It's read today by Leslie Betts, and know that for all the heartache Lord Byron had caused her in her life, she went to her own grave years later, still madly in love with him.
November 1824. Sir, I hope you will excuse my intruding upon your time. With the most intense interest, I have just finished your book, which does you credit as to the manner in which it is executed, and, after the momentary pain which it excites in many a bosom, will live despite censure and be gratefully accepted by the public as long as Lord Byron's name is remembered. Yet, as you have left to one who adored him a bitter legacy, and as I feel secure the lines, "Remember thee, though false to him, though fiend to me," were his, and as I have been very ill and am not likely to trouble anyone much longer, you will, I am sure, grant me one favor. Let me to you at least confide the truth of the past. You owe it to me. You will not, I know, refuse me. It was when his first child, Harold, came out, upon Lord Byron's return from Greece, that I first had the misfortune to be acquainted with him. At that time I was the happiest and gayest of human beings, I do believe, without exception. I had married for love, and a love most romantic and ardent. My husband and I were so fond of each other that, false as I too soon proved, he never would part with me. Devonshire House was at that time closed for my uncle's death for 1 year. At Melbourne House, where I lived, the waltzes and quadrilles were being daily practiced. Lady Jersey, Lady Cowper, the Duke of Devonshire, Miss Milbank, and a number of foreigners were coming there to learn. You may imagine what 40 or 50 people dancing from 12 in the morning until near dinner time, all young, gay, and noisy, were. In the evenings, we either had opposition suppers or went out to balls and routs. Such was the life I then led when Moore and Rogers introduced Lord Byron to me. What you say of his falling upstairs and of Miss Milbank is all true. Lord Byron, 3 days after this, brought me a rose and carnation and used the very words I mentioned in Glenarvan. With a sort of half-sarcastic smile, he said, "Your ladyship, I am told such as these are all that is new and rare for a moment." I have them still. And the woman who, through many a trial, has kept such relics with the romance of former ages, deserves not that you should speak of her as you do. Byron never, never could say I had no heart. He never could say either that I had not loved my husband. In his letters to me, he is perpetually telling me I love him, my husband, the best of the two. And my only charm, believe me, in Lord Byron's eyes, was that I was innocent, affectionate, and enthusiastic. Recall those words, and let me not go down with your book as heartless. Tell the truth, it is bad enough, but not what is worse. It makes me so nervous to write that I must stop. Will it tire you too much if I continue? I was not a woman of the world. Had I been one of that sort, why would he have devoted 9 entire months almost entirely to my society, have written perhaps 10 times in a day, and lastly have pressed me to leave all and go with him? And this at the very moment when he was made an idol of, and when, as he and you justly observe, I had few personal attractions. Indeed, indeed, I tell the truth. Byron did not affect, but he loved me as never woman was loved. I've had one of his letters copied in the stone press for you, the one just before we parted. See if it looks like a mere lesson. Besides, he was then very good to what he grew afterwards. His health being delicate, he liked to read with me and stay with me out of the crowd. Not but what we went about everywhere together, and were at last invited always as if we had been married. It was a strange scene, but it was not vanity misled me. I grew to love him better than virtue, religion, all prospects here. He broke my heart, and still I love him. Witness the agony I experienced at his death and the tears your book has cost me. Yet, sir, allow me to say, although you have unintentionally given me pain, I had rather have experienced it than not have read your book. Parts of it are beautiful, and I can vouch for the truth of much, as I read his own memoirs before his publisher Murray burnt them. Keep Lord Byron's letter to me. I have the original. And some day add a word or two to your work from his own words, not to let everyone think I am heartless. The cause of my leaving Lord Byron was this. My dearest mother, now dead, grew so terrified about us that upon hearing a false report that we were gone off together, she was taken dangerously ill and broke a blood vessel. Byron would not believe it, but it was true. When he was convinced, we parted. I went to Ireland and remained there 3 months. He wrote every day long, kind, entertaining letters. It is these he asked Murray to look out for and extract from when he published the journal. But I would not part with them. I have them now. They would only burn them, and nothing of his should be burnt. At Dublin, God knows why, he wrote me the cruel letter, part of which he acknowledges in Glenarvan in the letter of the 9th of November, 1812. He knew it would destroy my mind and all else. It did so. Lady Oxford was no doubt the instigator. What will not a woman do to get rid of a rival? She knew that he still loved me. I need not tire you with every particular. I was brought to England a mere wreck, and in due time, Lady Melbourne and my mother, being seriously alarmed for me, brought me to town and allowed me to see Lord Byron. Our meeting was not what he insinuates. He asked me to forgive him. He looked sorry for me. He cried. I adored him still, but I felt as passionless as the dead may feel. Would I have died there? I should have died pitied and still loved by him, and with the sympathy of all. I even should have pardoned myself, so deeply had I suffered. But unhappily, we continued occasionally to meet. Lord Byron liked others. I only him. The scene at Lady Heathcote's is nearly true. He had made me swear I was never to waltz. Lady Heathcote said, "Come, Lady Caroline, you must begin." And I bitterly answered, "Oh, yes, I'm in a merry humor." I did so, but whispered to Lord Byron, "I conclude I may waltz now?" And he answered sarcastically, with everybody in turn, "You always did it better than anyone. I shall have a pleasure in seeing you." I did so, you may judge with what feelings. After this, feeling ill, I went into a small inner room where supper was prepared. Lord Byron and Lady Rancliffe entered after. Upon seeing me, he said, "I have been admiring your dexterity." I clasped the knife, not intending anything. "Do, my dear," he said, "but if you mean to act a Roman's part, mind which way you strike with your knife, be it at your own heart, not mine, for you have struck there already." "Byron," I said, and ran away with the knife. "I never stabbed myself. It is false." Lady Rancliffe and Tankerville screamed and said I would. People pulled to get it from me. I was terrified. My hand got cut, and the blood came over my gown. I know not what happened after, but this is the very truth. After this, long after, Lord Byron, abused by everyone, made the theme of everyone's horror, yet pitied me enough to come and see me. And still, in spite of everyone, William Lamb had the generosity to retain me. I never held my head up after, never could. It was in all the papers, and put not truly. It is true I burnt Lord Byron in effigy, and his book, ring and chain. It is true I went to see him as Carmen, after all that. But it is also true that the last time we parted forever, as he pressed his lips on mine, it was in the Albany, he said, "Poor Caro, If everyone hates me, you, I see, will never change. No, not even with ill usage. And I said, yes, I am changed, and shall come near you no more. Then he showed me letters and told me things I cannot repeat, and all my attachment went. This was our last parting scene. Well, I remember it. It had an effect upon me not to be conceived. 3 years, I had worshipped him. Shortly after, he married. Once, Lady Melbourne took me to see his wife in Piccadilly. It was a cruel request, but Lord Byron himself made it. It is to this wedding visit he alludes. Mrs. Lee, myself, Lady Melbourne, Lady Noel, and Lady Byron were in the room. I never looked up. His wife, Annabella, was very cold to me. Lord Byron came in and seemed agitated. His hand was cold, but he seemed kind. This was the last time upon the earth I ever met him. Soon after the Battle of Waterloo took place, my brother was wounded and I went to Brussels. I had one letter while at Paris from Lord Byron, a jesting one, hoping I was as happy with the regiment as he was with his wife, Belle. When I returned, the parting between them occurred, and my page affair, and Glenarvan was published. I wrote it in a month under circumstances that would surprise everybody, but which I am not at liberty to mention. Besides, it has nothing to do with your book and would only tire you. Previous to this, I once met, and once only, Lady Byron. It was just after their separation occurred. She was so altered I could hardly know her. She appeared heartbroken. What she then said to me, I may not repeat. She was, however, sent away, but she did not go willingly. She accused me of knowing everything and reproached me for not having stopped Byron's marriage to her. How could I? She had been shewn my letters and everyone else. It is utterly false that she ever opened the desk, and Nurse had nothing to do with the separation. From that hour, Lady Byron and I met no more, and it was after this that, indignant and miserable, I wrote Glenarvan. Lady Byron was more angry at it than Byron was. From that time, I put the whole, as much as I could, from my mind. Lord Byron never once wrote to me, and always spoke of me with contempt. I was taken ill in March this year. Mrs. Russell Hunter and a nurse sat up with me. In the middle of the night, I fancied I saw Lord Byron. I screamed, jumped out of bed, and desired them to save me from him. He looked horrible and ground his teeth at me. He did not speak. His hair was straight. He was fatter than when I knew him and not near so handsome. I felt convinced I was to die. This dream took possession of my mind. I had not dreamed of him since we had parted. It was, besides, like no other dream except one of my mother that I ever had. I'm glad to think it occurred before his death, as I never did and hope I never shall see a ghost. I have even avoided inquiring about the exact day of his death for fear I should believe it. It made enough impression as it was. Of the ghostly Byron, I told William and my brother and Murray at the time. Judge what my horror was, as well as grief, when, long after, the news came of his death. That was conveyed to me in two or three words. Caroline, behave properly. I know it will shock you. Lord Byron is dead. This letter I received when laughing at Brocket Hall. Its effect, or some other cause, produced a fever from which I never yet have recovered. It was also singular that the first day I could go out in an open carriage, as I was slowly driving up the hill here, Lord Byron's hearse was at that moment passing under these very walls and rested at Welwyn. William Lamb, who was riding on before me, met the procession at the turnpike and asked whose funeral it was. He was very much affected and shocked. I, of course, was not told. But as I kept continually asking where and when he was to be buried, and had read in the papers it was to be at Westminster Abbey, I heard it too soon, and it made me very ill again.
Whatever you might think of Lord Byron, John Keats was his polar opposite. Another one of those great romantic poets of English literature, Keats was anything but Byronic. Sweet and gentle and truly a gentleman of the first order. Here's one of Keats's early love poems to his beloved Fanny. It's read by John Stephen.
March 1820. Sweetest Fanny, you fear sometimes I do not love you so much as you wish. My dear girl, I love you ever and ever and without reserve. The more I have known you, the more have I loved. In every way, even my jealousies have been agonies of love. In the hottest fit I ever had, I would have died for you. I have vexed you too much, but for love, can I help it? You are always new. The last of your kisses was ever the sweetest, the last smile the brightest, the last movement the gracefulest. When you passed my window home yesterday, I was filled with as much admiration as if I had then seen you for the first time. You uttered a half-complaint once that I only loved your beauty. Have I nothing else then to love in you but that? Do not I see a heart naturally furnished with wings imprison itself with me? No ill prospect has been able to turn your thoughts a moment from me. This perhaps should be as much a subject of sorrow as joy. But I will not talk of that. Even if you did not love me, I could not help an entire devotion to you. How much more deeply, then, must I feel for you, knowing you love me? My mind has been the most discontented and restless one that ever was put into a body too small for it. I never felt my mind repose upon anything with complete and undistracted enjoyment, upon no person but you. When you were in the room, my thoughts never fly out of the window. You always concentrate my whole senses. The anxiety shown about our love in your last note is an immense pleasure to me. However, you must not suffer such speculations to molest you any more. Not will I any more believe you can have the least pique against me. Brown has gone out, but here is Mrs. Wiley. When she is gone, I shall be awake for you. Remembrances to your mother. Your affectionate, J. Keats.
Not all great love letters are written by famous young poets, or even by famous older poets. Here's one written by the wife of that great author, Thomas Carlyle. It was penned by Jane Carlyle, and indeed, she remains, as Virginia Woolf once claimed, one of the great English letter writers of all times. This next letter was written to Jane's husband as he was about to board a ship destined for foreign parts. It's read by Carol Peterson.
Dearest, if you go on board tonight, this letter will reach you no sooner than if written tomorrow and addressed to Scottsbrig. But if you do not, and tomorrow there be a second day for you without any news, you will be vexed, and on no account must you be vexed, if one can possibly help it. I cannot, however, make much of writing today, for it is thundering and raining in a quite soul-confusing manner. That in the first place, and in the second, I have a headache. I did myself no good by cleaning the lamp in the morning. It had ceased to act some time ago, and was beginning to lie heavy on my conscience. Besides, that light is one of the things I do not like to economize in when I am alone. Just the more alone I am, the more light I need, as I told Darwin the night he drank tea with me. When the lamp was brought in, he remarked that it was surely far too much light for a single woman. I am sitting in the upstairs room now, while the earthquake is rumbling beneath it, and this and the thunder are almost too much for me. They have washed the ceilings, and Helen is now washing the paint and doing the impossible to clean the paper with bread. Ah! It takes such a quantity of labor, for a man quite inconceivable, to make what is dirty look one shade more near to the clean. But here it is, all quite clean and so pretty. I feel like a little queen sitting in it, so far as what Mazzini calls the material is concerned. Indeed, I suppose no queen ever got half the comfort out of a nice room, queens being born to them as the sparks fly upward. There are still some finishing strokes to be given, the bookshelves all to be put up, and the window curtains, and a deal of needlework has to go to the last. But when all is done, it will be such a pleasure to receive you and give you tea in your new library when you have exhausted the world without. Thanks for your constant letters. When you come back, I do not know how I shall learn to do without them. They have come to be as necessary as any part of my daily bread. But, my dear, I must stop. You see that my head is bad and that I'm making it worse. Bless you. Yours, Jane.
Nor are all great love letter writers British. Few Englishmen or Englishwomen can match the likes of our next contributor, the great French novelist Gustave Flaubert. Here's Brian Peterson reading Flaubert's short but very suggestive missive.
August 15th, 1846. I will cover you with love when I next see you. With caresses, with ecstasy. I want to gorge you with all the joys of the flesh, so that you faint and die. I want you to be amazed by me, and to confess to yourself that you have never even dreamed of such transports. When you're old, I want you to recall those few hours. I want your dry bones to quiver with joy when you think of them.
Whew! Might want to catch a breath of bracing winter air. Never let it be said Flaubert ever wrote anything boring. But on to Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning, two very single and very prim and proper British poets in merry old Victorian England. When they first met in 1845, it was love at first sight, and indeed they lived happily ever after. Well, mostly. Here are two letters, one from each of them, that tells the story of that first meeting and what sparked their romance. They are read by Karen and Rob Filipkowski.
10 January, 1846. Dear Robert Browning, do you know, when you have told me to think of you, I have been feeling ashamed of thinking of you so much, of thinking of only you, which is too much, perhaps. Shall I tell you? It seems to me, to myself, that no man was ever before to any woman what you are to me. The fullness must be in proportion, you know, to the vacancy. And only I know what was behind. The long wilderness without the blossoming rose and the capacity for happiness, like a black gaping hole before this silver flooding. Is it wonderful that I should stand as in a dream and disbelieve not you, but my own fate? Was ever anyone taken suddenly from a lampless dungeon and placed upon the pinnacle of a mountain without the head turning round and the heart turning faint, as mine do? And you love me more, you say? Shall I thank you or God? Both, indeed. There is no possible return from me to either of you. I thank you as the unworthy may, and as we all thank God. How shall I ever prove what my heart is to you? How will you ever see it as I feel it?
You will only expect a few words. What will those be? When the heart is full, it may run over, but the real fullness stays within. You asked me yesterday if I should repent what I have professed, for I have performed nothing. It seems to fall short of what my first love required even. And when I think of this moment's love, I could repent, as I say. Words can never tell you, however I form them, transform them in any way, how perfectly dear you are to me, perfectly dear to my heart and soul. I look back, and in every one point, every word and gesture, every letter, every silence, you have been entirely perfect to me. I would not change one word, one look. My hope and aim are to preserve this love, not to fall from it, for which I trust to God who procured it for me, and doubtless can preserve it. Enough now, my dearest. You have given me the highest, completest proof of love that ever one human being gave another. I am all gratitude and all pride, under the proper feeling which ascribes pride to the right source, all pride that my life has been so crowned by you. God bless you. Your very own, Robert.
Up next, we have another curious pair of letters, this time written by two Churchills, father and son, and both often wrote to the loves of their lives, their wives. The first letter was written by Winston Churchill's father, Lord Randolph Churchill, as he timidly approached a very witty and very pretty young Jenny Jerome. She was an American girl Lord Randolph had met and was immediately smitten with on the Isle of Wight. As it turned out, they did get married, and young Winston was one of their two happy results of that marriage. But when it comes to Lord Randolph and Lady Jenny's youngest son, that great long-winded speechmaker, Sir Winston Churchill, we're struck by how few words he uses in his love letters, and yet how powerful those letters are to his wife Clementine, even late in his life. Here's Mark Wormke reading first Lord Randolph's letter to Jenny Jerome, and then one of Sir Winston Churchill's last letters to his wife, Clementine.
August, 1873. I cannot keep myself from writing any longer to you, dearest, although I have not had any answer to either of my two letters. I suppose your mother does not allow you to write to me. Perhaps you have not got either of my letters. I'm so dreadfully afraid that perhaps you may think I am forgetting you. I can assure you, dearest Jeanette, you have not been out of my thoughts hardly for 1 minute since I left you Monday. I have written to my father everything, how much I love you, how much I long, and how much I would sacrifice if it were necessary to be married to you and to live ever after with you. I shall not get an answer till Monday, and whichever way it lies, I shall go to Cowes soon after and tell your mother everything. I'm afraid she does not like me very much from what I have heard. I would do anything she wished, if only she would not oppose us. Dearest, if you are as fond of me as I am of you, nothing human could keep us long apart. This last week has seemed an eternity to me. Oh, I would give my soul for another of those days we had together not long ago. Oh, if only I could get one line from you to reassure me, but I dare not ask you to do anything that your mother would disapprove of, or has perhaps forbidden you to do. Sometimes I doubt so, I cannot help it, whether you really like me as you said at Cowes you did. If you do, I cannot fear for the future, though difficulties may lie in our way only to be surmounted by patience. Goodbye, dearest Jeanette, my first and only love. Believe me ever to be yours devotedly and lovingly. Randolph S. Churchill. 23rd of January, 1935. My darling Clemmy, you wrote some words very dear to me about my having enriched your life. I cannot tell you what pleasure this gives me, because I always feel so overwhelmingly in your debt, if there can be accounts in love. What it has been to me to live all these years in your heart and companionship, no phrases can convey. Time passes swiftly, but is it not joyous to see how great and growing is the treasure we have gathered together amid the storms and stresses of so many eventful and, to millions, tragic and terrible years? With tender love from your devoted Winston.
Another very short yet powerful love letter was written by that great New Zealand short story writer, Catherine Mansfield, to her husband, J.M. Murray. And what a pair! Their long simmering and eventual torrid romance would catch the notice of their mutual friend D.H. Lawrence, who used it as the basis for his famous novel, Women in Love. Here's Carol Peterson reading Mansfield's letter written in the first year of her marriage to Murray.
My love for you tonight is so deep and tender that it seems to be outside myself as well. I am fast shut up, like a little lake in the embrace of some big mountains. If you were to climb up the mountains, you would see me down below, deep and shining and quite fathomless, my dear. You might drop your heart into me, and you'd never hear it touch bottom. I love you. I love you. Good night. Oh, bogey, what it is to love like this.
Probably there is no sadder nor inspiring love story this side of the Atlantic than the one between F. Scott Fitzgerald and his beloved Zelda. And though Fitzgerald is well known for his novels, including The Great Gatsby and Tender as the Night, Zelda can hold her own as a writer of love letters. Here's Lynn Stewart reading one of Zelda's letters to her Scott.
Spring, 1919. Sweetheart, please, please don't be so depressed. We'll be married soon, and then those long, lonesome nights will be over forever. And until we are, I am loving, loving every tiny minute of the day and night. Maybe you won't understand this, but sometimes when I miss you most, it's hardest to write. And you always know when I make myself. Just the ache of it all. And I can't tell you. If we were together, you'd feel how strong it is. You're so sweet when you're melancholy. I love your sad tenderness when I've hurt you. That's one of the reasons I could never be sorry for our quarrels, and they bothered you so. Those dear, dear little fusses, when I always tried so hard to make you kiss and forget. Scott, there is nothing in all the world I want but you and your precious love. All the material things are nothing. I'd just hate to live a sordid, colorless existence because you'd soon love me less and less. I'd do anything, anything to keep your heart for my own. I don't want to live. I want to love first and live incidentally. Don't ever think of the things you can't give me. You've trusted me with the dearest heart of all, and it's so damn much more than anybody else in all the world has ever had. How can you deliberately think of life without me? If you should die, oh, darling, darling Scott, it'd be like going blind. I'd have no purpose in life, just a pretty decoration. Don't you think I was made for you? I feel like you had me ordered, and I was delivered to you to be worn. I want you to wear me like a watch charm or a buttonhole bouquet to the world. And then, when we're alone, I want to help, to know that you can't do anything without me. All my heart, I love you.
When it comes to American women, few can rival Amelia Earhart, who's back in the news recently as there's new evidence of possibly finding her plane that disappeared without a trace when she attempted to fly across the Pacific Ocean in the summer of 1937. Miss Earhart, to those who knew her personally, apparently was as daring in her writing and her personal life on land as she was in the air. On the morning of her marriage to publisher George P. Putnam, whom she lovingly called GPP, she sent this letter to him as he waited nervously for her at the church where they were to be married. It's read by Karen Filipkowski.
7 February, 1931, Noank, Connecticut. Dear GPP, there are some things which should be writ before we are married, things we have talked over before, most of them. You must know again my reluctance to marry, my feeling that I shatter, thereby, chances in work which means most to me. I feel the move just now as foolish as anything I could do. I know there may be compensations, but I have no heart to look ahead. On our life together, I want you to understand I shall not hold you to any medieval code of faithfulness to me, nor shall I consider myself bound to you similarly. If we can be honest, I think the difficulties which arise may best be avoided should you or I become interested deeply, or in passing, in anyone else. Please let us not interfere with the other's work or play, nor let the world see our private joys or disagreements. In this connection, I may have to keep some place where I can go to be by myself now and then, for I cannot guarantee to endure at all times the confinement of even an attractive cage. I must extract a cruel promise, and that is, you will let me go in a year if we find no happiness together. I will try to do my best in every way and give you that part of me you know and seem to want. A.E.
Now that's chutzpah. Apparently, George was okay with Miss Earhart's proposal, and the wedding went off without a hitch. Of course, young love, as Amelia feared, has a way of sometimes getting lost in a hectic marriage. If you don't believe that, listen closely to this next letter. It was written by Dylan Thomas to his wife, Caitlin, whom he called Cat. It would be an understatement to say this couple had a wild and woolly marriage, but the truth is they loved each other very much, as can be seen from this letter read by John Stephen. Thomas, by the way, wrote it while on a publicity tour in the United States, while Cat remained back in Wales, a separation neither wanted nor could either tolerate.
Cat, my Cat, if only you would write to me. My love, O Cat. This is not, as it seems from the address above, a dive, a joint, saloon, etc., but the honorable and dignified headquarters of the Dons of the University of Chicago. I love you. That is all I know. But all I know, too, is that I am writing into space, the kind of dreadful, unknown space I am just going to enter. I am going to Iowa, Illinois, Idaho, Indiana, but these are on the map. You are not. Have you forgotten me? I am the man you used to say you loved. I used to sleep in your arms. Do you remember? But you never write. You are perhaps mindless of me. I am not of you. I love you. There isn't a moment of any hideous day when I do not say to myself, it will be all right. I shall go home. Caitlin loves me. I love Caitlin. But perhaps you have forgotten. If you have forgotten or lost your affection for me, please, my Cat, let me know. I love you. Dylan.
We did promise you at the top of the show love letters both sublime and ridiculous, and we certainly think this next and last item contains both. It was a letter, actually a poem, written by Kenneth Fearing, an American novelist in the first half of the last century, probably during the Second World War. It seems to sum up all that can be said about the real truth of 20th century romances, whether young love or old love. Here's Jeff Bowman reading Fearing's letter about his on-again, off-again, sometimes girlfriend, perhaps wife.
All right. I may have lied to you and about you and made a few pronouncements a bit too sweeping, perhaps, and possibly forgotten to tag the bases here or there, and damned your extravagance and maligned your tastes and libeled your relatives and slandered a few of your friends, okay. Nevertheless, come back. Come home. I will agree to forget the statements that you issued so copiously to the neighbors and the press, and you will forget that figment of your imagination, the blonde from Detroit. I will agree that your lady friend who lives above us is not crazy, bats, nutty as they come, but on the contrary, rather bright. And you will concede that poor old Steinberg is neither a drunk nor a swindler, but simply a guy, on the eccentric side, trying to get along. Are you listening, you, and have you got this straight? Because I forgive you, yes, for everything. I forgive you for being beautiful and generous and wise. I forgive you, to put it simply, for being alive. And pardon you, in short, for being you. Because tonight you are in my hair and eyes, and every street light that our taxi passes shows me you again, still you. And because tonight all other nights are black, all other hours are cold and far away, and now, this minute, the stars are very near and very bright. Come back. We will have a celebration to end all celebrations. We will invite the undertaker who lives beneath us, and a couple of boys from the office, and some other friends, and Steinberg, who's off the wagon, and that insane woman who lives upstairs, and a few reporters, if anything should break.
We hope you enjoyed our trip through the ages with these poor love-struck souls as they struggle to find just the right words to express their undying love for their life partner. But especially for those Canadians out there listening and who may be wondering why we didn't have any Canadian love letters in our show. Well, the truth is, our researchers tell us they're still waiting on getting something worthwhile to read. So, time to get cracking. Better still, why not sit right down this very minute and tell somebody you love them in, say, 100 words or so, and after the love of your life has read or heard that short, effusive, and powerful testament, worthy of a Hallmark card at least, then why not send it off to our researchers for next year's show? We hope to be here same time next St. Valentine's Day to offer up all the sublime and ridiculous things Canadians say about one another, especially about how and why they love certain ones of us. I'm Kristen Marchand, and for Jeff Bowman, Leslie Betts, Karen and Rob Filipkowski, Carol and Brian Peterson, John Stephen, Lynn Stewart, and Mark Wernke, we'd like to wish you all a very happy St. Valentine's Day. Meanwhile, our producer, Barry Conway, says, "Ah, nuts to the whole bunch of you. Just get on with living your life as best you can where you are with who you've got. Enough said. Good day, and God bless."